This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2019, held at Faith Builders from July 29 through August 2.
Welcome. I see you guys found some handouts. Thanks for attending, and I appreciate your interest in the hills and the valleys. And the opportunity that I have to share with you the geology from a young Earth perspective. I want to share this with you because, as you well know, our culture today, not our culture, our world has rejected the text of Genesis and the account, Noah's account of God's judgment on the earth and the catastrophic nature of that judgment. And so they have come up with alternative explanations for the geologic record, and they've concocted painfully slow processes that explain that evidence. And what I want to do with this talk is look at local geology and explain it. The core of what I want to say is that it can be explained. The evidence can be explained through the text that we read in Genesis. And so I hope you can glean some information from this presentation that you can use with your students to help them see that and be comfortable with, you know, going to a museum and seeing millions of years, and going to a state park and seeing, this thing was, millions of years ago, and the fossils are millions of years old, and even maybe your textbooks, or maybe your textbooks avoid it altogether. So as I said, we want to look at local geology and see the evidence in light of what Scripture says. And I wanted to start out with the big lonely boulder that's in the field down the road. Did any of you see that on the way in here? It's just a few miles down the road. Maybe you didn't come in that way. It's down near Cochrane. Every time I come in to visit FB here, I see this big, lonely boulder in the field. Hit the right button here. And it has a story. It has a story of Earth's history that it can tell. And so I want to tell that story, because I want to be able to look out the window and say, how did the landscape form? And I don't want that story to be told by the typical millions and millions of years. Do any of you have a school with a view like this? Boulders and rocks and rocky mountains? I didn't think so. I assumed that for sure you didn't have a view of the keyboard of the winds up there. I assume that your schoolyard probably looks more like this, just grass and field. And what we want to do is look at local geology, and I want to open up a chasm in your yard. Not a literal canyon, but in your mind's eye, a grand canyon that exposes the story of the earth, and then you see it through Genesis 7 and 8. And just a brief introduction of my family. This is my wife, Regina. She's around here this week. This was at our daughter Julie's wedding last September. Julie married Jared Miller. He was from the Middlefield, Ohio area, and they live in our area. Our oldest daughter is Daisy. She's married to Titus Coons, and they live in the Middlefield, Ohio area. And they have two children, Rowan and George. And they are the coolest, sorry about that, some of you have grandchildren. These are the coolest grandchildren there are, right? Titus is J. Mark Coon's brother, in case you know. Well, there he is back there. Our third son is Carlin. He's the tech guy around here at FB. So you'll see him around here. Our fourth child there is Wesley. He just turned 21. He wants to work in a coffee shop, and he's also an ultra runner. And so is Nevin, our youngest. And Nevin works at AF. He's a loan closer and a Baptist Financial. And Wesley wants, like I say, he wants to work in a coffee shop. But these two guys are ultra runners. They love to run. They can run. On the 10th, they're running a 100-mile race. I'd love to be able to do that. Imagine what I could explore. I'm a little jealous. But that's my family, in case you want to make a few connections of that. And let's jump right in here and dig in with looking at this lonely boulder in the field. I zoomed in with my camera. I didn't walk out there. But I'm assuming that that's an erratic. I think it's actually a granite crystalline rock. Its lithology is different. It's made up of different materials than the bedrock around here. The bedrock around here is shales and some sandstone. So it was transported here from somewhere else. If that one isn't granite, just up the road's another one. This is a very big granite crystalline rock boulder sitting in someone's yard, and FB just up over the hill here a little bit. This is a few miles down the road. And there's another one out Plank Road, just right out here. It's probably less than a mile. There's one sitting along the road, and here you can see the crystalline structure of the boulder, the quartz and the feldspars, and it's a granitic rock from Ontario. That's the closest bedrock where you can find granitic rock.
Any trouble crossing the border, do you think?
I doubt it. as you can see here, it looks like it was out in the field. It popped up, and they just pushed it down to the edge of the field. It's in the edge of the field. It's just a waste boulder. Here's another one a little east of here, a couple of country blocks away. This one looks like a granodiorite, just sitting there. It's not as big as the others. But it's definitely another, Canadian boulder, a foreigner, an erratic, a glacial erratic. Notice the topography around it, the rolling knob and kettle. This, a lot of the land around here is these rolling little hills, and the kettles have a lot, like there's a little pond in here, so there's a lot of wet areas, and that's called knob and kettle. It's also called moraine topography. And if you look at this LIDAR map, they have hill shade. It's a statewide map. And here's Guy's Mills where we're at. And here's where that granodiorite was on this road right here. And you'll notice this convoluted, kind of chaotic terrain kind of trending from the northeast towards the southwest there. That's that rolling knob and kettle terrain. That's the moraine topography. Here's a aerial photo. You can see right down through here, and it has a name. It's called Dead Ice Terminal Moraine. And just a little brief introduction or a comparison to modern glacial stuff. This is Mount Rainier, and this is Emmons Glacier. It's the largest glacier in the continental U.S. And I'm standing on the lateral moraine. So the glacier forms up here on the mountains and by gravity comes down through. And as it does that, it carries rocks. They fall off the mountain sides. It plucks them, the ice gets into the rocks and pulls them, plucks them off the mountain. And it bulldozes them down the mountain by gravity. As it moves down, so it used to come down here, and it makes this windrow along the side, this steep-sided, long, nice ridge. That's the lateral moraine, just like a farmer breaking head, clouds to the side. And let's move up close to the glacier. You can see the ice and its load of rocks. And as it melts, it dumps them chaotically and unsorted. Just big boulders, little, you know, sand, just everything. And for scale, my boys are rakier and rakier. You see that for scale. It's very chaotic. It's knob and kettle terrain. And here's looking back to the glacier, looking down the valley. You can see the long, you know, steep-sided, the lateral moraine along the left side there. And notice this mound here. And also notice in the amongst the brush there is kind of that chaotic moraine dumping of material as the glacier melted back. Here is looking at that same pile. You can see that random, unsorted, and chaotic terrain. And then down again on that lateral moraine, farther down, is the terminal moraine, where the glacier stopped, paused there, dumped a lot of its material. And here's a topographic map with hillshade. You can see the glacier right here at the beginning of the White River, and the lateral moraine running nicely down through here, and the terminal moraine. And it probably went farther down in the past, and you can see there's a couple other little moraines there, but it really paused here for a while and dumped a lot of material. And here's that same topography, the random, you know, pattern as we see here at Dead Ice Moraine. So imagine that. The great continental ice sheet from the Ice Age came right here to Guy's Mills and died. Dead Ice Moraine. If we zoom out a little bit, we can see that the map shows that to the west of us, in the northwest, Guy's Mills is like right in here somewhere near the Crawford County Jiggly boundaries. And to the west, northwest of us, it's a pillowy, kind of muted landscape. And then outside of the moraine, it's more incised and rugged because the glacier didn't bulldoze it and it didn't dump its load of material on there and melt and leave and just leave it there, covering everything, muting it and making it all pillowy looking like that. So yeah, just imagine that from here to the Hudson Bay, nothing but ice. Here's an old map showing the continental ice sheet of the Ice Age and here you can see we're up in that northeastern corner, the northwestern corner of PA, and it catches a little bit of western PA and some of northeastern PA way down into the bottom of Illinois and then back up through. The ice left us a lot of other evidence. Like here is the West Liberty Esker, you know, that little stream, that White River running out from under the ice. As the stream runs under the ice, it can kind of melt the ice and dumps its load of gravel, so it kind of builds up in this snaky, random kind of pattern. And that's not real far from here, West Liberty Esker. In north central Pennsylvania, a little town called Eaglesmere, these are striations. So as the ice moved along, it was carrying those boulders and rocks and sand, and it scratches the rock, the bedrock. And so some of those areas are exposed here in PA. Erratics are all over. Once you get above the ice, the terminal moraine, like this is actually up in Maine. This was called Bubble Rock. It was sitting there, you know, ever since the Ice Age till Carlin pushed it off. Just kidding. The glacier polished, you know, with all that sand and gravel, it polishes rock. Here you can see it's very slippery. The children were enjoying sliding. And here's a chatter marks from a rock, you know, going along, cracking, chipping off rocks. Here's a crescentic fracture. You know, big, heavy boulder with a lot of force getting to the edge of a ledge can make these crescentic fractures. And around the ice, you know, not everything, you know, what the ice actually directly caused. Surrounding it, there's a lot of paraglacial features that are here in PA. This is just one of them. The ground freezes in polygons. the big cracks, just like the mud cracks, you know, freezes in big ones, and it also floats the rocks. It freeze thaws, and the rocks float out and down into these cracks. So all over, you know, north central Pennsylvania, where I live, you can see these, here's one side of the polygon, here's the other one. So it sorts the boulders. You walk trail at Bald Eagle Boys Camp, you can see boulders and nothing, and a lot of them are sitting on edge because they floated out and dropped down into those cracks. There's a lot of Ice Age animals that lived around. I found horse teeth in Florida. Know people that have found, you know, some of these critters, mammoths and mastodons, they were around. You can see my arm is muddy. This is a fresh mastodon leg bone that I dug up near SMBI. In fact, here. Well, okay, I made a copy of it. But that's the, this is the forearm, the ulna, and the radius lays right here as well. The forearm of a mastodon, which is like a woolly mammoth. And that was just in a couple of feet of mud along the third baseline of a ball field. So if you have a ball field at your school and there's mud there, be a digger. Here was the bone scatterer, you know, the scapula and the ribs and the vertebrae. Pretty impressive. I found cave bears, dire wolves, musk ox. I found a piece of a ground sloth tooth in Florida, and of course the saber tooth. So we were surrounded by a lot of fossils as evidence that the climate and the fauna that was around was different during this ice age. And the ice age left its mark after it melted back. The ice built up over the Hudson Bay and spread out, and the Great Lakes are where it was at its maximum digging, excavating. So it excavated the Great Lakes, not just our Great Lakes, but, you know, Lake Winnipeg, Lake Athabasca, the Great Slave, Great Bear Lake. You can see that line of Great Lakes there. So this was quite a excavating machine. And the valley glaciers, wherever there's glaciers and ice, snow-covered mountains now, the glaciers were bigger, but they've melted back. Like here in the Rocky Mountain, you can see, you know, when I hiked to that glacier where we took the pictures, that's way up here in the top where nobody was, you know, 8 miles in. But the glacier used to come way down here, and you can see this, you know, steep-sided, long, nice ridge. You know what it is? Lateral moraine. Covered in trees, so the glaciers melted back. And it left these surficial deposits here in Pennsylvania. They're on the top. They're, you know, right here around us in Guy's Mills and in where we live, and it covers a lot of Ohio, Indiana, and of course New York. And the reason it pinches off right here in the northwest is because of the Allegheny Plateau, the mountains here. So that the elevation of the mountains caused the ice to kind of split around it. So if you have a student that's sitting there, you know, staring out the window, not these guys, they're just goofing off, but this guy right here, this imaginary one, sitting there looking out the window, maybe he's thinking about deep and profound things, like how was the landscape or form that's around me. So we want to look at that. This is a map, a geologic map of Crawford County, and so we're right in here somewhere. And these colors represent different layers of rocks. Here's a closer up of a geologic map, and Meadville's out in here, so it doesn't come as far east as we are, but it gives you a rough idea of how a geologic map works. And then here's the key, the different colors of the rocks, you know, the sandstones and the shales and the limestones, and where they're bedrock, what's under our feet, underneath the surficial deposits. And here you can see the orange. The orange is this Conemaugh group, or whatever, Conowingo group, and it's Devonian and Mississippi, and above that, like the purples are some sandstones. It gets maybe even up into a little Pennsylvania on some of the hills. And I'm not going to get into how many millions of years ago these were. You know, Devonian is what, 250, 300 million years ago. That's what the traditional explanation is. But I just wanted to for you to see this visual here of this sandstone, these layers of rock, and how they were eroded, leaving some of the harder capped rocks of the sandstone on top of the hills. And you can see the cross section on this geologic map. And then here's a larger one from this is from about somewhere out in Ohio. I think it's near Kelly's Island, comes down into Bedford County. So it's not quite through this area, but it gives you an idea how there's all these different rock layers, and there's the Appalachian Basin over here to the east of us, and the rock, the sedimentary record gets a lot deeper out through there. And the traditional explanation for this is millions and millions of years ago there was this tectonic orogeny, and the mountains were pushed up in eastern United States, and the rain and the rivers wore away the mountains over eons of time and carried those sediments out here into the Appalachian Basin and buried them, and they turned into rock. And then there was another orogeny where all these folds were, and these mountains were, 5 miles high in central Pennsylvania, and the rain and the wind and the sun and the rivers wore them away until we see what we see today. But we'll go through some of that and explain it a little later on. And I just wanted this also for a visual. So this is right under our feet, right? Yeah, underneath this blanket, this muting, this pillowy surficial deposits left by the glacier, there's these layers of bedrock. And if we would drill down, we'd find these. And you can see the valley fill. Now, if you go out here in this valley where the swamp is and you drill down, you may have to drill through hundreds of feet of surficial deposits of that glacial till that the glacier left when it melted away. Maybe you teach a school in central Pennsylvania, like this is Lock Haven Mennonite from school where I'm from, and you might have a student that's sitting there staring out the window, pondering deep and profound things. And maybe you can push them in the right direction, right, by understanding how did that mountain form? God made them, right? How did he make them? We'll look at that a little bit. Here's a closer up, zoomed-in view of the mountain, this Bald Eagle Mountain, this big block field here. That's a glacial relic from all the freeze-thaw during the cold period. Those rocks were where the freezing and thawing broke up bedrock at the top of the mountain there, and it worked its way down. And here's a bedrock exposure at the bottom. Here's my daughter and my son for scale. You can see the rock layers are tilted. This is layers of shale and mudstone, some limestone, and it has ripple marks on it. And that funny texture you see there is millions and millions of ostracods, which actually happen to be swimming in this little puddle. That's what my son is showing right there. He has a little cup of water with little ostracods. They're like clams, right? Little bivalves. They open up their tiny little shells and they swim around in the water. And this is supposed to be, 265-million-year-old deposit with these millions of ostracods that look the same today as they did, millions of years ago. So you can see the rock layers were originally laid down, generally speaking, horizontally, and they've been folded up, tilted steeply like this. Here's another map view. You can see the relief of the mountains. Here's a Lock Cave and Bald Eagle Boys Camp is up here, and that mountain we were looking at is right here. And I just want to show you this little cute valley, this oval valley here, and so you can kind of understand how the rock layers express themselves in the landscape that we see today. That is actually called oval. And here, Jared and Julie are looking out over the valley. You can see the mountains curve around. You see there's a double ridge coming out through here, and behind it's another one that's held out by harder rocks that are more resistant to erosion. Here comes down the other side, that double ridge. And I just want to give you a visual of how that's formed by looking at this geologic map. And again, you can see the rock layers are represented by different colors. And there's oval, And on the geologic map, you'll have like these letters here, this line through. That's where the cross section will be. So we're going to look at these cross sections on the geologic map so you can get a visual of the rock layer. So here we have, I can't read that, sorry. Anyway, Oval is one of these valleys. It really doesn't matter. It's all the same ridge. It's just different cross sections up through. And I'll just zoom in on this one. You can see Bald Eagle Mountain. And these rock layers here are the Tuscarora Sandstone and the Bald Eagle Quartzite. They're Tuscarora Quartzite and Bald Eagle Sandstone. They're very hard rock layers. And the layer was deposited and then folded up into this giant, you know, mountain where the rocks came over like this in a hump, in an anticline, and were wore away by some forces, and as the traditional story goes, right, they were wore away by the wind and rain and sun over eons of time. And just again, you can see those rock layers and envision that giant of a mountain that's now gone and just leaving the stump there in this oval shape. And you have that double ridge because there was two layers of harder, more resistant rock that are expressed in the landscape because the softer, more erodible rocks are wore away, so you have the valleys in between. Maybe you have a student that's at SMBI, and they're sitting there in the library, staring out the window, pondering deep and profound things other than the word and the studies that they're doing, wondering how that mountain was formed. I grew up right around the corner here, and so this mountain is special and interesting to me, Sidon Hill. And it's made differently than Bald Eagle Mountain. So we'll look at that. This is a cross-section of Route, 40 or 60 something down in Maryland through the Sidon Hill Cut. And you can see this is a syncline where the rocks were folded down. And so when you fold the rocks down, that pinches any cracks tighter, right? So they're more resistant to erosion, whereas if you fold them up this way, then they'll want to crack open and so they're more likely to erode. So a lot of mountains are, in central Pennsylvania and other places, are syncline, the heart of a syncline here. And you can see the extrapolated rolling, you know, mountains there that have been wore away by forces that we'll talk about later on. Here's the backside of Sidon Hill. You can see that cross-section there, syncline. And here is standing on Sidon Hill, SMBI is right out here in case you've ever been there. And you can see these rock layers are tilling down under my feet. And just picture these mountains here that have worn away. And picture with me, you know, the eons of time have mountains pushed up, wore away, deposited here, folded up again, and wore away. That's the story that we all hear, right? No, it tells a different story. Part of that wearing away that we see around here in Pennsylvania is a peneplain. That's what it's interpreted as. The tops of the mountains are pretty much all level. Like if you take a topographic map, set a level on it, it's kind of all flat. So their story is the Appalachian Mountains here in the Allegheny Plateau were wore down to sea level, and then there was another uplift, and then the rivers, valleys that we live in today and farm in, they were wore down from that peneplain. There's other explanations for it. Here's just a close-up of that topographic map, or the geologic map. So you can see all these folds and these missing mountain rock layers. I'd like to include in this some, extra ingredients for it. These are bonuses, right? These are, I'm switching gears now. I don't know if you can follow in your notes there, but I'm switching to extras. There's more in the fossil record that we can interpret and explain from the Genesis account. Something that you see very frequently throughout any exposed bedrock where there's sandstone is cross-bedded sandstone. See all these lines here? That comes from sand waves. So the deep, fast-moving water is flowing along and it's rolling sand grains along the bottom and makes those waves, those ripple marks, big ripple marks. And you can see the water was moving this way here, and these are the forceps. So the sand grains roll up the wave, and it's wearing it away. And it's depositing them down the front. They kind of roll down the front in that turbulence in front of this sand wave. So there you can see the forceps. So they get preserved because as the sand is deposited, it's kind of building up this bed of sand, and the forceps are preserved. In the Grand Canyon, there's the famous Coconino sandstone, this cliff former. That's about the height of our mountains in central Pennsylvania, that cliff there. And this is the Coconino sandstone, and it is cross-bedded. You can see the forceps there, big sand waves. And they are interpreted by anywhere you go as a giant desert. Or sand dunes. But I've been to many presentations and talked to scientists that have investigated these and say absolutely not. They're aqueous deposits. They've been deposited in water. Those are, there's all kinds of evidence that's actually deposited by water rather than by wind. In fact, while we were there, in the Coconino sandstone, there's lots of tracks. Here you can see a track. Have you ever made tracks in a sand dune? They do not preserve like this. You can see the claw marks. And that track is barely the size of a quarter. It's very small. And I've seen big ones as well. And they're all interestingly skewed. I mean, yeah, you can see their tracks because you can follow them on the bed of the forceps. They're all walking upstream, and they're all kind of on an angle. They were walking in current, and the tracks are very well preserved. Just one little evidence that this is an aquatic deposit in water. Canyon de Chelly, White House ruins. You see the cross bedding there. This is a different sandstone, but it's interpreted. The Canyon de Chelly sandstone is an Aeolian sandstone with cross stratification. So there you have it. Your museum, your park is going to tell you it's a desert. So picture that. There's the White House ruins, desert. Millions and millions of years. But you can also look at the evidence, and if you look at it closely, you can see that it was deposited by water. So think of the scale of that, this giant storm rather than a giant desert. You can see there's rock layers above it. Vast areas of the United States are covered in sandstone, like this is the Coconino here, but there's other, very similar deposits that correlate with the Coconino sandstone, and even our cross-bedded sandstone, some people say correlate. And they also say that the sand source is the Appalachian Mountains. Like here you can say, this is a traditional explanation of it, and they're saying that it's carried by a transcontinental river system that carried the sand from the Appalachians out there to the Grand Canyon and deposited them by wind. The rivers carried them, and then the wind blew them out into these dunes. That's what they're trying to explain. So I just wanted to, give you a visual on some of the sandstone deposits that are evident in the U.S. Like this is the Tapete sandstone, and this colored area is where it is evident, either by drilling or exposed. The Tapete sandstone is the very first sandstone layer in the geologic, in the sedimentary record. If you go down into the Grand Canyon, you come to the Tapete sandstone and you go through that, and then you come to the Great Unconformity, and then you're in crystalline basement rocks, or rocks that were deposited pre-flood, Cambrian rocks, depends on how you want to interpret that. And here's a little paragraph that talks about the Tapete sandstone, and it's the base of what is known as the Sauk mega sequence. And these Sloss mega sequences are fascinating. It's kind of a newer study, and I'm just suggesting, if you're really into geology, that you pay attention to these, because these Sauk mega sequences, there's five of them, and they're deposited on continental-wide erosional unconformities. And that is, you know, the rocks that are supposed to be there are eroded away. You can see an erosional surface where these Sauk mega sequences start, and the Tapete sandstone is the first layer. And so, interpreting from a biblical standpoint, that were, you know, the text of Genesis, that would have been the beginning of the flood, right? So, for the fun of picturing that, the Sauk mega sequence, the very beginning of this giant package of sedimentary rock. And here's the aerial extent of it in the U.S. And this is by Clary and Werner. Later on, I'll get in your handout. There's a link to this article here by Clary. It's a fascinating study. The guy was an oil geologist, and so he has access to all the well cores from, you know, all the drill cores, and so he's put them all together, and he can give you these sequences and all this material. It's really, really amazing. Tippecanoe, Kaskaskia, all these different sloss mega sequences that have been deposited in the sedimentary layer. And some of these sequences are a lot thicker than the other, and they really vary. Like here you can see, notice how, so here he has the Tejas, the Zuni, the Absarca, the Kask, you know, the different colors, and you can see how they're thicker in some areas, and it's fascinating because he can reconstruct the geography of the pre-flood world using these well cores and these mega sequence cross sections. Another ingredient of the fossil record is fossils, and the millions and millions of years that go along with it, right? How, you know, 65 million years ago, the dinosaurs, you know the whole story, right? And so we tend to kind of avoid them or don't really understand how the dinosaurs, the evidence is there, and we want to look at it so we can interpret it, we can point our students in, a biblical direction. Here's tracks, dinosaur tracks. Here's some more. This is in Colorado. There, you know, the salt layer was worn away, and so you can see the imprint from the dinosaurs there. Here, I took a group of boys to New Jersey, and we all found our dinosaur track. There's some molds of some of the ones we didn't bring home over there. Well, the big ones from right here where I was standing in New Jersey. The small cast is from the bridge down at Gettysburg, the bridge to Little Round Top. They were building a bridge, and there's a rock on there with a dinosaur track. So in Pennsylvania, you can find dinosaur tracks. In New Jersey, in eastern part. And if you're out west, you can see, you know, the Dinosaur National Monument and all those huge dinosaur bones that are all washed in there. Along with that, there's really neat fossils in PA, the Pennsylvanian fossils, the coal fossils that made coal, and they have these reconstructions of the what the trees look like, the tree fern. Here's a root of the tree fern. You see all the rootlets. See how it was a hollow root and collapsed when it was deposited. course of the surrounding rock. And then back there, some of the leaves, and oh, here's one, some as well. You can take a look at that as you leave, with the, you know, the fronds, the leaves, the fronds of these tree ferns, giant tree ferns. And here's a Calamites stem. It's like a horsetail. You know, you see driving along the road, you see the horsetail growing in the wet areas. This is like a giant version of those. And here's at Longwood Gardens, you can see some tree ferns similar to what would have been back then in the pre-flood world. You go exploring in, you know, old mines or whatever. In coal regions, you can see the fire clay where all the rootlets are, and the ceiling of this particular mine is just lined with giant pieces of the bark, and there's some back there on the desk as well, of the bark of the tree ferns. And the tree ferns were the source of the coal. They were compacted and turned into coal. And the traditional explanation is, right, that it was a swamp, and these trees grew there, and they fell down, and turned into peat, and, you know, millions of years later, now we have coal. There's a better explanation. Here's the roots of those aquatic roots of the tree ferns, and more, you know, bark in the coal formations. And it's more fossils that we find. Trilobites, there's a lot of them. They're part of the marine deposits. There's a number of trilobites back there. Here's one. Found it in my driveway. You know, you just break a rock open, and inside is a trilobite. And I forgot to show you. Here's a dinosaur bone I dug up in New Jersey. Well, okay, it's a mosasaur, which was what, like an aquatic, you know, something like an alligator or whatever. But I dug up a few of them, and the guy that was there from the Academy of Natural Sciences, he says, that's the caudal vertebrae of a mosasaur. So, trilobite tracks, you can find tracks. A common fossil that you find is crinoid, little cheerios, the crinoid stems. This particular rock, there's a piece of it back there. It was big. I just broke off a few pieces. But there are vast deposits of crinoids. I mean, there was a whole layer there, right? Just shell fossils. I've seen cliffs on them, little cliffs just full of shell fossils and layers full of fish fossils, one after the other, preserved there. I actually have a microscopic fish on this one. Somewhere on here, you need a microscope. I can't see very good. There's fish on here, and there's also fronds of a special plant. You see, I was at a cliff base of the Catskill Formation with a fellow from the Academy of Natural Sciences. We were jackhammering out a piece of the cliff because we could see bones sticking out. And it rolled down the mountain and busted open. There was a 16-inch wide fish tail. That's all that was there. And then we moved over a few feet to this rock area where this tiny fish were. And he said, Dana, this is where we came out of the swamp. And he told me the story. These tiny little fish are here, dead, because it was right over the time when fish were getting out of the water and moving onto the land and growing feet. But these branches, these leaves, were the first land plants. They were colonizing the land, and they were making oxygen so the fish could actually get out on the land. And it's a great story. Very unbelievable, but a great story. So I'm just trying to say there's these vast deposits of marine fossils everywhere you go. And there's some more cephalopods and crinoids and shells and so we have to interpret that when we look at the evidence around us in the geologic record. Another thing that we need to incorporate into our understanding of the landscapes around us are impact craters. Now, this one's on the top. This is a superficial deposit. This is a meteor crater. But there are a lot of fossil craters. Like here in Holliford, Ontario, this is the Holliford crater. It's a fossil crater. It was buried in sedimentary rock, and the ice moved along and excavated it. We revealed it so we can see it. This one is Brent Crater, way up in the upper part of Algonquin Park, in the middle of nowhere. You have to drive down a 30-mile-long dirt road, nothing but trees, to get to this spot here where you can see the crater edge. You can see, you know, there's lakes in the bottom, limestone in the bottom, and breccia. You know, the huge impact melted the rock and made this breccia melt. Serpent Mound here in Ohio is another fossil. You know, the Serpent Mound is made in a fossil crater, and the biggest, you can't see anything of that crater, really. It's expressed in the land somewhat. But I went to a creek and busted some rocks, and it didn't take long to find a shatter cone. The force of that huge explosion shatters the rock, and you can see those typical shatter cones. So the Chesapeake Bay is another impact crater. There's 100, 150, 200 impact craters worldwide that are known, and most of them are in the sedimentary, in the fossil record. So they happened during the time when the sedimentary rocks were being deposited. So we need to interpret them in light of Noah's account. Here's the big one, right? Chicxulub impact crater made this huge tsunami and deposited all these deposits way up in, you know, the Dakotas and whatever, and you can find, you can picture, and there they are, all these fossils and rock layers. Another ingredient in the story is volcanism. There's vast areas of volcanic deposits here in the United States. This is just a bentonite layer, and these red lines right here are the bentonite layers. You see them folded up here. So those were from volcanic ash. And out west, driving along, you see a lot of basalt, just vast deposits of basaltic rock. Here, one of the boys is trail running, you can see way out through, you know, just vast, black deposits. And those are the Columbia River basalt. Here's where we were, where that picture was, in this basin here. This is just the Columbia River basalt. And it's exposed because there was a giant flood, the Missoula flood. A giant glacial lake, you know, busted its dam and ran through here. And you can see all these channeled scabbling. If you ever seen it, that's a surficial, you know, evident, one of those little relics of the Ice Age. But it exposed nicely a lot of those basalts. Here's the falls, and looking down, you know, the valley there, and it, you know, there, the Columbia River basalt. See if I can read. Anyway, it's millions of just vast areas of these basalts. They're lava flows that happened during the time that our story of Earth and the geologic record. And so how do we interpret what we've seen? I'm going to run back through these real quick here. How do we interpret this to our students? How do we look at what we see in light of Genesis? Well, I think I have the reference in your notes there, in Genesis 7. it says the fountains of the deep were broken up. So likely the flood included volcanism, right? And so, and tectonic events breaking. And so there was these vast deposits of volcanic material during the flood. It says in Genesis 7 that the windows of heaven were open. And we know that during these the period of time when the sedimentary rock layers were laid down, there were a lot of impact craters, hundreds of them, big ones, little ones, lots of them. And so we can look at that and say, oh, well, that didn't happen over millions of years. It happened in a year's time during that cataclysmic global worldwide catastrophe that God used to judge the earth. The windows of heaven were open. And so that was a factor in the formation of the world we see. The sandstones and all these sedimentary layers. You know, the next verse says, the waters were lifted up. The ark was lifted up and the waters increased. The ocean came onto the land, as you can see from the peat sandstone, deep, fast-moving water. And that erosional surface, the great unconformity, when the ocean came onto the land, and that would involve a lot of tectonic movement as well, as either there was plate subduction, like some people think, or like others try to interpret it as just more of a vertical up and down movements of the Earth's crust, rather than the subduction and the scraping and moving around like from here and Pangaea breaking. There's various ways to interpret it, but the fact is, somehow the Earth moved, and it moved a lot. Just look at it. Compress those millions of years into a year's time. That's a lot of Earth movement. The marine fossils, that's another part of that, right? The ocean came onto the land, it's carrying all those marine fossils, it's depositing them. The waters were lifted up and prevailed upon the earth. There's where you can understand that the water was deep and fast and depositing vast sandstone layers that they show up right there in Noah's account as the waters increased and they prevailed upon the earth. They prevailed exceedingly upon the earth. And every living substance was destroyed which was upon the face of the ground, including the dinosaurs, including the trilobites, and they were on the ark, got off the ark, but they died out like the mastodons and the mammoths. That's a way to look at Earth's history. And another thing to look at is the pre-flood world was vastly different than what we see today, maybe genetically. And God has given people and everything the ability to kind of drift, because think about it. You go to South Carolina and you see the Hunley, this tiny little guy. Any of you crawling the Hunley? They were little people back then. Well, that's maybe some environmental factors, but also could be some genetic drift. And so the animals that got off the ark may look vastly different to us than they do today, because God has given amazing ability for genes and their expression to change. The fossils, the world was destroyed by that water that was so incredible and destructive, and it left us the record And then it says the waters assuaged after 150 days of this terrible storm, this cataclysmic event where you can barely imagine how judgmental it was. We have a God that can really stir up a storm. So the mountains were, you know, being lifted up, being formed, being deposited, and the waters assuaged. And so the Appalachians had been pushed up early in the flood, and then when they assuaged, it says they returned off the face of the earth. And so there you have a fast moving deep water eroding those mountains, shearing them off, just planing them off. There's your planation that most people would say, oh, that was sea level. Well, it was the waters returning off the earth, at least my interpretation of it and others. And where did it go? That's a common question. Well, all I need to say is, look at that picture of our blue planet. That's where the water went. And then, because of all that volcanism, all those aerosol, volcanic aerosols in the air, we have a cool atmosphere and a warm ocean, and that's the ingredients for a storm. Like here, the freak hailstorm in Mexico, this was just a few weeks ago, furry Guadalajara in, 5 feet of hail in minutes. Hail is the fastest way to build up ice, right? So if you have a warm ocean, you have a cool atmosphere, you have a heat engine, you have a way of making giant storms. And so you can easily and quickly build up, you have cool earth, you can easily and quickly build up an ice sheet. And that's a much better explanation than the typical ice age. I was at a talk, a guy from the University of, I don't know where he was now, it was many years ago. He was explaining the ice age, and afterwards I said, so give me an ice, how do you form an all ice? I don't know how you make an ice age. I said, I know how. I said, just blow off all the volcanoes in the Mid-Atlantic Rift, what happens? Oh yeah, he said, that would do it. But he can't picture it, right? So the ice age left, it melted, right? It was gone, and it left us all these awesome relics. The valley glaciers melted back, leave us what we see today. And guess what? Earth settled in, climate settled in, and we have a lone boulder sitting in the field with a story to tell. And I hope that story is clearer to you and you have a chasm in your yard where you can see exposed the story of Earth through Noah's text, where he describes what God did to judge the world. And we want to believe that story rather than the story that man wants to give us and the world wants to give us, because they don't want to believe the truth. Any questions?
Where do we define a fossil crater? Why is it called a fossil crater?
It's a fossil crater because it was buried in the fossil record, in the sedimentary rock. That's how I would describe it. It's not on the top. It's not a surficial deposit. It might be now, but it was in the layers of rock, like maybe happened in the Devonian times.
Formed by something striking the earth.
Yeah, it would have been an impact during the time when the Devonian was on the surface, and then it got buried by the younger layers of rock. Yes.
Question for you, Dane. I live here in the area, and there's a gas well in my place. They told me when it got to 3,000 feet, there were 200 feet of pure salt. You know, can you comment on that? And
I don't.
Yeah.
I would love to know. That's one of the big questions that I have, is where did the salt come from, and how was it formed? I don't know. I've never done any reading on it from a creationist, from a Genesis standpoint, to know. I'm sure it's out there.
Yeah.
And let me point you to that in the back of the handout if you have it. Creation ICC, is that what it says? don't have any notes.
ICR.org.
This one. CreationICC.org, if you don't have a handout. That is a scientific, it's where all the creation scientists get together every 4 years and present their research papers. And you can go to that website and they have their proceedings, and most of them are online where you can read them. And you can search it and see if anyone talked about the salt. Okay. And then it will open up their vast store of knowledge. I can't give it to you all now, but I highly recommend that site because you can read, like, Clary's paper. I was talking about the SLOS mega sequence. It's in there. Stephen Austin's presentation on how shale is formed quickly. You know, typically you put a little silt in and shake it up, and it takes forever to make shale. Well, you can do it. All you have to do is add a flocculant, right? And you have shale. And it's deposited by fast, deep-moving water. Surprise, surprise. Rather than millions of years. Any other questions?
I used to think of the Ice Age as just a part of this whole million years myth. So it was an Ice Age, but how long did it last, or how did it end, or...?
Yeah, it would have started shortly after the flood, as I understand it, and it's thought to have lasted about 700 to 1,000 years. Some people say about the time of Abraham. Some people say about the time of Joshua. And I've seen some studies on how, how snow and ice leave in the wintertime. It's all of a sudden catastrophic. It's gone. It sits there and sits there, and the sun starts melting it, and then the dirt starts showing up on it, and that exacerbates the problem, right? And so they think it may have been like 70 years is gone. Just all of a sudden, that ice just melted away, and then the earth settled into a climate similar to what we see today. I mean, the glaciers are still melting back. The glaciers are melting, it was only a few thousand years ago. They're still melting down. It's not us. All right. Well, thanks for your attention and participation, and I hope you gleaned something that you can push your students toward believing Genesis rather than the world.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.